Balcone's first ever year-round bourbon was an inspiration. It all had to work together. A blend of carefully selected ingredients, Texas-sized pot stills, and creative people determined to find the absolute best way to usher a new whiskey along. When you discover how it pairs with a meaningful moment, suddenly the feeling of drinking great whiskey becomes a whole lot more.
Welcome to another episode of Whiskey Neat, spirited conversations with interesting people. I am your host, Christopher Hart. Man, oh man, oh man. So I know what you're seeing here is like, that is a weird mix of bottles in front of Chris here. And for those listening, I apologize. But so last week we kind of touched, I know this has kind of been beat to death, so this will be the last conversation on it. But well, unless we can get a certain Texas made Sotol in and talk about why they're the bad guy. But last week I mentioned that there was an error in our previous week. The error being that when Morgan came in to discuss terroir and spirits, he actually presented a pretty solid argument, except for the glaring loophole that he was using different species of plants. So we resolved that today. I get to taste two different Sotols made at the same place by the same person, same distillation proof. I'm sorry, they're off by 1 degree. So one slight variance, but the species of plant are the exact same. The only difference is where those plants come from, regional, the terroir, the earth, and that. So I'm joined by good friend Mike Groner. I actually wrote this down. I said it on the show. I'll say it again. CEO and president of Genius Liquids, creator of the original podcast on spirits in Texas, host of Show de V with Mike G, a direct reference to brandy, Eau de V, which is weird because he's known for making gin and Sotol. Let's see here, hailing all the way from the land of weird, Austin, Texas, and named after the sound you make every time someone asks about blends. Mike Groner. His friend Drew, who just moved to Houston, joins us for a brief discussion over how terroir, especially in unaged spirits, is a real thing. But also, we just kind of needed to catch up. I love Mike. I love his show. He is zoning in on 300 episodes. He's been doing it for like 5 years. Ridiculous. The vision that this guy had before anyone else in the state of Texas. This week's show is, as always, sponsored by Terlato Distill Artisan Spirits, leader in premium artisan products like Bunnehabhain, Deanston, Lecheg, Tobermory, Baines, Black Bottle, and, of course, Scottish Leader. Whiskey Neat is supported by the Inspired Spirits at Glass Rev Imports and Amroot Distilleries. Amroot crafts one of the most award-winning Indian single malts with the exact same standards as Scotch. Amroot Fusion also received a double gold blind and scored a jaw-dropping 96 points by judges at the Proof Awards. Amroot single malt whiskey is widely available across America and can be found almost everywhere in this great state of Texas. I mentioned Whiskey Wild last week. My friends AJ Paulson and Brent King put together a pretty neat travel case for Glencairns, for sample bottles. You can check all that out at whiskeywild.com. That's WYLD. They are not sponsors. I'm just supporting a good product because it deserves the attention. Also, those of you who have been sticking around since our Sam Heughan episode, with Sassenach Spirits has been launched in 5 states. Now, many of you have been messaging me over the past couple of months saying, what states? What are the 5 states? Well, I haven't been able to say it because nothing was finalized yet. But those 5 states are California, Texas, Florida, New York, and New Jersey. And currently, you can pre-order your Sassenach Spirits bottles at reservebar.com. They will mail to those 5 states. Sassenach Spirits, I have often trashed celebrity-endorsed spirits, but if you watch that episode with Sam, it's very clear that he's not just trying to make, he's not trying to milk you for money. He loves the beautiful spirit that is Scotch. So he very much has my support. I think that pretty much covers all of it. We have some very exciting news coming up soon, but next week's episode, which is filmed later today, is with Campbell Brown, the head of Old Forester, the fifth generation Brown Foreman family guy. Like he's the man, the top of the, he's not a sales rep. So I'm excited to sit down with him in a couple hours. We'll talk then. And yeah, I think that's pretty much it. whiskeymerch.com. Check out our shirts. We did receive an email from one Scott Kelly. Now, for those of you from Houston, you're thinking of the astronaut. It's not. The email basically says, my son Richie is 22 and is a huge fan. He's unfortunately going through leukemia, and anything you could send his way. So we are going to be sending you some shirts, some swag, a couple of hoodies. And that I wanted to send you booze, but I don't think you're allowed to send people going through that sort of treatment alcohol. So we are going to be sending you some things. So shout out to Richie, shout out to his dad for being a great dad, and that is out of Greer, South Carolina. So fun to know we have listeners there. So without further ado, Mike Kroner, his friend Drew, let's talk a little bit, put a little feather in the cap of terroir. Cheers. Drew, very nice to meet you, my friend.
Likewise.
I'm excited to have this conversation. Mike Groner, how's it going?
Oh, no, you did not.
You don't like that at
No,
all.
It's fine. I mean, eventually people want to see what I'm doing on LinkedIn, right?
Well,
yeah, I actually just learned how to pronounce it last night.
Speaking of which, there's a couple people that I have met doing this or whatever will only call me Whiskey Pete.
Oh, really?
Which is just that's Whiskey Pete. It's just a little cartoon I do for Instagram. And I, to the point that I wonder if they think that that's my name is Pete. So I say I've been saying Mike G, showed a view of Mike G, the original spirits show in Texas. Uh-huh. I've been saying Mike G nonstop. I want people to know that I do know your last name, that we are friends.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
I'm excited to have you
on
the
Chris
show.
Chris Hart has a great ring to it. Mike G, two syllables nails that's the best kind of branding you can have.
Well, the my day job, we often go by first initial last name, so I get K Hart a lot.
That's cool too.
And there was this great girl, known her a long time. She works for NASA has worked for NASA. She would call me Chris Hart Mario Kart, just like right the K Hart Mario Kart, just like the perfect. So I like the little two syllable things. Yeah. Pretty cool.
I want to share what was really a damaging nickname for me.
Sure.
And Groner obviously has a bunch of rhymes.
Sure.
But when I was working at a radio station, oddly enough, when I was a kid, they said the Moaner, Groner, Boner, Donor. And it does have a good ring, but it certainly did shock me a little bit.
I did write something down specifically
could,
as
could
a play.
Could be taken as flattering.
Boner, donor, true. Yeah.
I was the victim of my last name being Jordan, so all through middle school I was Nerd and Jordan.
I like that, though. That's good.
Well, we don't have to talk about what Hart rhymes with. It's fine.
Oh,
we can skip that all
true.
Together. Yeah. Yeah. So I did write down today's guest, CEO and president of Genius Liquids, creator of the original podcast on spirits in Texas, host of Show de Vie with Mike G, a direct reference to unaged brandy, a.k.a. Eau de Vie, despite being known for gin and Sotol, gin and cultural appropriation. My gregarious and grumpy friend hailing all the way from the land of weird, Austin, Texas, and named after the sound you make every time someone asks about Blanton's, Mike Kroner. Welcome
like
to the show.
Oh, man. You know, it's funny because gregarious. Okay, cool. I'm really not that grumpy. I promise. I just like being sarcastic.
It's a slight reference to the name of what we started calling our spirits that we're bottling, which is gregarious.
That rum that's coming
spirits.
Out, right?
My sister-in-law years ago said you were very, because online I think sometimes you can come across more succinct and more aggressive.
Sure.
But in general, I am a very lovable, gregarious, let's talk. Yeah. I mean, I'm so excited about today. And Drew mentioned off air that he had heard our last two episodes touching on terroir, and he actually had something that he wanted to propose. So I'm going to go ahead and let you give me the whole,
all right,
your thoughts on it, and while we get a little loosened up, and you can tell me what you brought and why you wanted to discuss it.
Well, I brought two bottles of Sotol that were distilled by the same Sotolero that Morgan mentioned in the episode, but as you pointed out in a correction in the next episode, they were different species of plants that he had brought in.
Sure. Just as a little recap, and I know we've kind of talked about this quite a bit, but the discussion two episodes back was about whether or not terroir was a feasible thing. Morgan Weber brought together a he came prepared for a great discussion, and in the midst of it, I did not realize that he was basically presenting us the difference between a Cabernet or a Pinot, a different grape varietals. So it makes it hard to cement that argument that terroir is possible. So you actually brought same species, same Sotolero, same place, and the only difference is...
The only difference between... what goes into this bottle and what goes into this bottle is that they were harvested a couple of years apart. And why that is especially relevant here is that the Desilirion genus, those plants take about 15 years to regenerate after they've been harvested. And so if you go through and harvest all of the mature plants in a particular plot of land, it will be 10 to 15 years before you can harvest plants from that same plot of land. So by necessity, these are from... different areas. I couldn't point them on a map.
Sure.
I couldn't get into the kind of detail that a winemaker might get into about, you know,
but same species.
Hills.
And all from Chihuahua, right?
Yeah, all from Chihuahua. This will be, Citrus Onum tends to grow in the area southeast of where the actual facility is, so toward Coahuila. Oh,
okay.
Southeast part of the border between Chihuahua and Texas. But these were distilled by the same person in the same place using the same species of plants, but plants that were harvested in a different season in a different area.
Sure. So that would speak to that if there was a massive difference in taste or even a nuanced difference in taste, you would speak to the terroir itself. So, and I know that, again, the show's called Whiskey Neat. We've been doing a lot of Sotol talk lately, but it's especially more evident in this case. Because the wood's not influencing the spirit itself, so what you're tasting is going to be straight from the still to the bottle, you know, give or take some proofing down.
Well, this is the thing too. Like, so the assertion is, just so I'm kind of caught up, that terroir plays a little part with unaged spirits, or plays a big part.
Mike Raymond from Reserva to One basically asserts that the standard thought process of regions of Scotland being that the islands are all smoky peated, each region has exceptions that don't bug. You know, for instance, the Highlands are very much known for their sherried, this and that. And he said that this is all nonsense, especially because a lot of the peat or barley that these distillers get are from other areas.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that terroir plays a massive influence in what most people, the way it's being used to market scotch, is not what real terroir is.
I want to offer up one thing. This is the only logic I ever really have about what terroir means. So agave, Desilirion, these have a lifetime spent in the wild. Far longer lifetimes. Introduced to harshness, drought, wet season, dry, everything in between, heat, cold.
Many years.
Yeah, many, many years. And a single grain gives up a season. So the level of maturity and the crap it's seen, that's the way I always look at it. It's like agave's got to put up through a lot. Like a Tempestate lives over 20 years or whatnot. And it's the crap it's seen. And so that exposure and that maturity and that aging and that harshness, much like Clint Eastwood's face, like, that's what you taste. And so terroir is really, really a real thing.
If Clint Eastwood was a plant, it would...
Or Lee Marvin or a snare drum, either way. But yeah, so that's kind of the thing, is that can you really, with a single season of grain production, give the same nuance, the same harshness, the same resentment, the same jadedness, potentially, that the plant
The struggle.
Experience. The struggle, yeah. The struggle is
the
real.
The desperation.
Right? Yeah.
Is absolutely evident, I think, in desert plants.
Absolutely.
You can taste that. And I think there's one of the points, I guess, of having the conversation about this is that if you can establish that to some extent terroir does matter in an unaged spirit, then it can make more sense to talk about the source of your raw materials, even an aged spirit, if you can establish that to some extent this will, you know, the source of the plant will translate through distillation.
Well, and I think that, you know, like all things, the great thing about the English language is we get our words from other places, right? Like terroir is very much a French word.
Sure.
And words evolve over time. Even, you know, terroir has been used not in wine alone. It's used in coffee quite a bit. It's used in many other aspects of to speak to where the item comes from, right? Mm-hmm. The entire environment in which it is created. So I think I think that, at least in whiskey, if that word evolves a little bit to include where it's aged, right? Because that's the big thing about Texas is Texas is always about, it's way hotter here. We don't have the varying seasons the way that Kentucky has. Mm-hmm. It could be used, just not in the exact same way, unless you're speaking, I think, because it's hard to control all the factors, even within the same barrel, you know, when you order from Kelvin Cooperage.
Yeah.
Even when you give them the same specs for barrels, barrels vastly differ in the way that it affects the taste of the spirit.
And distillation is a huge piece of it too, right? So when you do sotol or you do other mezcals, you're talking about two full different distillations, an ordinario run and then the spirit run. So that single continuous process ultimately for bourbon, for lack of a better word, kind of sanitizes it, kind of neuters it. So you have these...
You mean like the column stool?
That's right, yeah. So like... You cook a steak too much, eventually you lose all the flavor. So there's the same component than distilling something. You can distill it to death. 25 times distilled, which is not the case with whiskey necessarily, that's not a good thing. And we've been kind of accustomed to try to think, rather the marketing's been, no, that's a good thing. 24, great quality.
Wheatley vodka's 10 times distilled, yeah.
But why? You would never cook a chicken breast that much. You would never cook veg that much. Like, give it some time and kind of take the control off a little bit. And that's why things like sotol, these particularly, are much more oily. They've got more fat. You actually have more unctuousness because you didn't cook it to death. And that is one of the reasons that agave spirits, dazzleron is not agave, but in the same family, that's why they're superior, in my opinion. Because they do...
Oh, I didn't know we were going to have that conversation.
No, it's not. It's just a statement. It's
them. A declarative. It's a good... Out.
Yeah.
No, I love whiskey. I mean, I'm drinking this Bombois cognac that y'all had, and this is excellent, too.
Yeah, so it's... You mentioned something before the show, and I think it's been greatly... So it's really fascinating, right? So you have people, especially in America, where our generational love and spirits usually comes from our family.
Right.
Right? My grandfather was this. My dad collected these. Mm-hmm. Decanters were a huge thing, right, in the 80s, because people weren't really drinking it as much as decorating their house with it, right? Mm-hmm. Cognac in a bourbon group is a hard sell, right? We had a lot of stores that were very nervous. They were like, look, I'll take 5 cases, but that's it.
And how many cases do you want?
81 cases, right?
That's not a lot either.
490 bottles, and it was a hard sell, even at that beautiful price. And just to kind of give a little peek behind the curtain, the cost to the stores were $66 a bottle for almost 2 weeks shy of 24-year-old cognac. And we presented a cask strength, great example of what cognac can be and not what people think it has been.
I completely agree, yeah.
But you point out the regions of cognac. Bonbois, which is where this is from, is actually the least desirable region.
That's the phrase. And this is excellent. I mean, the really I've had...
It's really bright. Have you tried it yet?
It's bright here.
Your cognac? Yeah.
Yeah. There is no bad cognac if it's natural, right?
Sure.
Boisé, which you said they're not using, which is great. No coloring, no added
sugars. No added colors, no added sugars, cash strength, single barrel. Yeah.
So even the worst cognac is a great cognac.
Sure.
Especially if you're going to get it over 40, because seldom do you find something that's old that's over 50. I had one that was about the same age, but evaporation took over, and you're talking 45 then out of the barrel without water. So... Bonbois is still incredible. The worst cognac still tastes good, but people don't even, they're not even at that point yet.
Yeah, they don't even realize what they're,
And that's okay. I mean, I don't care.
Yeah.
But I love trolling y'all.
You want to get your foot in the door and you want to show people. I mean, it's like, I don't think this is even remotely the best example of how great mezcal can be, but if you are not, my introduction to the category was through Del Maguey and the different offerings. Now, of course, it has been, I guess you would say, quite commercialized since, but
absolutely.
But my introduction to the category was when you can fall in love with something at this level, at the lower level, mm-hmm. and realize, oh, if this is this good at this level, what's it at this level, right? That was our goal.
That's a really cool goal. Because one, you never get cognac at this proof. Two, it's hardly ever this old. And three, you never get it from Bombois.
And we also, this price, and I've said this repeatedly, this price was, the supplier took basically almost nothing. Yeah. They might have lost money to give us this cask, but it was introducing something to Texas. They love HBS. They love what we're doing.
Yeah.
And so we are working on some more things from them. But I think such a great example. And of course, we raised almost $3,000. We were supposed to raise $24.50. That was $5 per bottle.
Yeah.
$24.50. but one store misunderstood Dandy Liquor and Katy. And so their portion would have been paying $150 to Camp Hope, a veterans charity here in Houston. And he accidentally donated $500.
Which is like the best accident ever, right?
Well, right, but it's also his entire margin. Like, so this store did something nice, sold something to the group, and then basically gave everything that he made on this. And it's not a very common thing for stores to do. They've got to keep the lights on. He sent me the receipt. I said, you only had to pay $150. He's like, it's fine. It's a good cause.
He's a good guy.
Yeah. Dandy Liquor and Katy. If you guys,
I'm from Katy High School. Do you know that?
I did not know that. But if you guys ever get a chance to check it out, it's right off I-10 in Houston. It's a great store.
Can I touch back?
Sure.
Now, I love this introductory thing. There should always be a delicate, open, inviting hand into cognac, into sotol, into mezcal, all of these things. And I appreciate what Don Legay has done for that category. I also think that because of the vast growth in the category, and I'll say this straight up, Don Legay has been very, very good to me as well. Evan, Ron, the whole team. But now,
would you say that Don Legay, you would know more than I would, but I think they've been part of the reason it's become so, the growth in the U.S., is people are introduced to the wide selection of SKUs at literally every single price range and are able to just prance through. And if you have thoughts on this too, feel free to speak up. But would you say that Don Legay has, I would say, maybe led the way for the growth in the U.S.? Or?
Sure. So here's a couple things. It was the first, okay? And I think this is a well-known thing. I'm not sharing any trade secrets. Ron's very proud of that, and I have him, you know, like we've talked about that, and I appreciate that. Also, it was very territorial, the entry of mezcal, a single brand. You can't just prevent other brands from coming in. Now, not that they did that, but we're at a renaissance of mezcal right now, probably for the next few years before it becomes very problematic. The quality is already changing. The immature agave is already kind of peering into some of these bottles.
Sure.
But you can start out with something like Recampero de Esperin that is higher proof, brighter profile for me, or Alepus San Andres, which is maybe $5 to $6 more than this, depending. And you're going to get a more accurate representation of what mezcal tastes like.
Sure.
So Don Legay definitely set the tone, and they have some marks that are just exceptional, like the San Amayaltepec from Puebla. This is incredible. But if you're going to start out, give yourself a little bit more richness and spend like $5 more, because at 80 proof this is great, but it tastes better in a margarita than it does by itself.
Sure.
And that's
That is also the point of Vita. It was intended to be a cocktail mezcal.
Sure.
But I think it is fair to say that in founding Don Legay, Ron created a market for mezcal. For real mezcal, because you could get Dos Gustanos,
right?
You could get Montalban, if you wanted to, and I did, and you know, that's not a good introduction to the category and turned people off of it for a long time. So, in that regard, I think Don Legay has done a real service to mezcal,
to the category,
to the category.
Yeah.
But I do agree that there are better starting points available now than this.
Yeah, no,
I got no bones to pick, Chris.
Sure.
I mean, this is a really big market now. Mezcal typically is up 11 to 13% year over year, which will outpace tequila, which was 11% this year, 19 over 18 overall case sales. So we're going to hit a real interesting point. But the thing is, too, I'll put this out here and you guys think about what this might mean. But when it says case sales, that's not consumer sales. This is case sales at probably a wholesale to a retailer level.
Well, that's the only way they can track it.
Exactly.
Right? So it's hard to...
Precisely. But do you need 12 marks? Do you need that many? Because that artificially inflates already what the case volume is going to be on the numbers themselves.
Sure.
Are people drinking these? Hard to say. You see plenty of...
I wouldn't say it artificially inflates. That's the solution, right? So if you're trying to look a way to optimize... volume for a category, it would make more sense to offer, you know, like they talk about bourbon growth or whiskey growth. Well, there are more marks than there have ever been right now, right? So I wouldn't say it artificially inflates it. It definitely waters it a bit down a little bit, you know. But I think what you're seeing is I think as a country, maybe as a culture, we are seeing a love of experimentation, right? Mm-hmm. I love going to a restaurant that I've heard lots about, and then some of those restaurants will have an option where you just kind of go along for the ride. Sure. You don't know what you're eating. They just bring you plate after plate. That is awesome, right? And it's the same thing. You go to a place like Rosewater. You mm-hmm. text me last night.
Beautiful.
Anvil, yeah. Right? And I want you work here every day. You know what's fantastic. You've tried lots of things. Take me for a ride. Introduce me to something. I hate to say this. I hate to say what I'm about to say because it's embarrassing. But I could
I'm relishing this moment, actually.
I could not get into gin up until 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I walked into Rosewater and I spent some time with Pasha. Mm. And he sent me through a fun, tasty, delicious ride of what gin can do, which is almost endless.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And it excites. Oh, if I like gin, okay, let's get into cognac. Let's get into mezcal. Let's find what's delicious. And Bonbois, I've never looked at it. It's not even on the.
I'm just trolling,
bottom
man.
Shelf.
I'm
bottom
just,
shelf.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
Let's see what they've got. And
I am gonna make a shirt that says Bonbois, though. No, this is like way too cerebral of a joke, especially for like 9:45 in the morning or whatever. But at its worst, it's still better than pretty much every new whiskey that comes out.
Oh, dude, I couldn't agree more.
People, and why do you? So I'm gonna, because you asked me a lot of questions when we were doing our interview. But why do you think people are so timid to enter the cognac?
Well, I think it's so this has been discussed. I did an episode with the head of the Black Bourbon Society, Samara Rivers, and her. I don't know if they got married yet, but her man.
Partner, right.
Her partner. They run the Black Bourbon Society. They have their own podcast together. Not Bottled in Bond, but it's a play on that. Bonded in Bourbon. And so I talked to them about it. And the belief by many is that the marketing techniques of the past have created stigmas, mm-hmm. right? So when you think of cognac, for a lot of people, it's Hennessy, or right. it's that this is not made for us, right? Or as white people or whatever.
I see.
And it's frustrated her. And so when she first started working with getting into the industry and working with the bourbon industry, and I won't say who the company is, but they've definitely made up for it. But they were sending her to shows and events and getting her feedback, and they actually had an image of what they were aiming for in the black community, and it was incredibly offensive. And it infuriated her. So she has made it her mission to introduce people of all creeds, all races, all spirits, to just kind of like, we don't have to fit into one category. There's so many beautiful, beautiful spirits out there. I mean, I'm sitting in front of two white guys talking about one of the most amazing spirits in North America.
Sure.
My
heart's in Mexico, though, Chris. I'm going to say that. No, it is, man. Like,
I mean, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
Mexico's still North America, right?
No, yeah, okay, thank you. Yeah, so and I'm not, still white, like literally.
Sure.
Right. But I'm going to say this one thing about cognac. Henny's cognac. Henny's not Henny, and people don't realize that Hennessy, although leading the global sales, is a fine cognac. It's a cognac. It's brandy.
Sure.
But that's not how it's seen. Oh, what are you drinking? Cognac? Oh, no, I like Henny.
So United Wine and Spirits is a distributor here in Texas that has a very precarious relationship with a big
Spec,
box store.
Potentially?
Well, I was just going to say a store, but
let
sure.
Let me say.
Yeah, Specs.
Yeah, right. Some strange things there.
Yeah, so the mentality, the thought... for a starting brand, for a lot of it, now not everyone may agree with this, but it has been my belief, and from what I've seen, that a great boost when you're trying to get into a market is to get into the United Wine Spirits rep on the Specs across the state.
Mm-hmm.
I think they have something like 190 stores or something in the state. That's a great boost initially, but eventually, when you're moving a ton of case volume, eventually it handcuffs you because you can't get into any other store at a comparable price because of the relationship.
It's a non-compete, ultimately. Now, it's not non-compete in the contract.
It's not an official non-compete.
But it's punitive pricing.
Yeah, yeah. So it has to do with basically pricing, right? So it was the same thing, in my opinion, when you market certain spirits to certain people. It's a great boost initially, but eventually as we evolve and move along as a culture, you not handicap, maybe handcuff yourself to a certain audience, right? Yeah. Vodka, flavored vodka. There will always be college students doing Jello shots and Jack and Cokes.
In acting, it's called typecast.
Right? Yeah. So you're typecasting a spirit.
That's
basically
right. Exactly.
Correct. Yeah.
So, no, I agree.
And that's her belief. And I listened to her on my show talk about it. And I said, that makes perfect sense. I feel a little nervous agreeing or believing in that. It feels a bit. I don't feel like I'm allowed to believe in stigmas. You know what I mean?
But that's fair.
It's a very uncomfortable conversation to have. But she makes a perfect point. And I think what we're seeing as a society is this adventure outside our own cultures and other spirits and falling in love with what is beautiful about them. And that is 100% what's happening when it comes to rum. I mean, sherry for a long time. Sherry, they say that the sherry industry is only alive because of scotch, but there are some fantastic sherries out there.
Yeah, but you're preaching to the choir here, but try to get someone to drink. We were drinking sherry last night, actually. It was Celsius 12 or whatever it was.
13 Celsius,
thank
yeah.
you. So, and they've got a brilliant selection of sherries. But try to talk to someone about the difference between Amontillado and Oloroso.
In the past few years have tried to get my foot in the door at a handful of wine bars just to expand my wine knowledge. And, you know, you and I being people who are passionate about sherry, I would walk in the door talking to somebody who has infinitely more knowledge of wine than I do. And I would ask them just out of curiosity, you know, what sherries do you carry, and get the response, we don't carry dessert wine. And I would just turn around and walk out because...
Yeah. Yeah,
it's humorous.
Yeah, like there's so much ignorance because you were saying, like the people are just now starting to become adventurous enough to try these things that have the stigmas that you talk about, and so in a lot of these categories, there's just an initial wall of ignorance that needs to be overcome, and once the market becomes more educated and people understand what this is and what the options are.
For years, people thought rum was Captain Morgan's.
Right.
There's still some. But what you are seeing is a thirst. I would say, I like to say this a lot, that whimsy. There's a little bit of fun in walking into a place. And a place like A. Roe Flint has an incredible selection of mezcals and sotols and whiskeys, right? But to walk into a place like that, and a lot of those places are now starting to do break-even bottles, so you can try something at ridiculously cheap prices.
Yes, I agree with Drew. There is this inertia that happens from within the industry or within the passion, the consumers, that goes outward, and they can influence and get people to come in. My dad single-handedly thanked me, even though he sends me pictures of whiskey all the time now. He's like, have you had this one? It's like, thanks for introducing me to this thing, because it takes just one spark, and then that's kind of ignited that passion. It takes that with sherry, it takes that with mezcal. But the thing is we still, and I want us to realize how insular this thing is. Talking about the differences between the same species of sotol distilled in different years from different vintages, hell yeah, this is something to discuss. But there's more education that has to occur. This is for us. We really, really love this. But that passion for those break-even bottles, which I think is a great concept, and we have yet to really adopt it in Austin, but it's still just for
attempt.
Us. There was an attempt.
The Townsends, they tried.
As a homage to Anvil, right? But it's improving, and that much I'm happy about. Cognac. I hope people are buying more cognac.
So it feels like help me understand here.
Sure.
What it feels like you're saying something is concerning you about this, but I'm not quite understanding what
it is. Okay. So the dichotomy is we praise these opportunities to taste things that are very, very rare and just beautiful as we're doing this morning.
Not just rare, but just all of the above.
Sure. These aren't necessarily rare. You can get these. The Bien Picado is a little rare. These Clandes aren't as rare, but nonetheless. So we're trying these really incredible spirits because we have the intelligence and the insight and the community to do so. But the problem is, unless we help educate outward, this is especially the case with mezcal, as Drew can say.
But that's what these groups are for, right? I mean, that's what your group is doing. That's what our group is doing. And I mean, there's a lot of ignorance around these. I wouldn't say... Unique spirits, I would say, maybe not as talked about as much, or not as much in the, I hate to abuse the word cultural zeitgeist too much, sure, but yeah. just
undiscovered, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah.
A good word.
Yeah.
So I mean, but it's still it's being talked about. That educate. What's not happening?
All right. So what I'm saying is that who's out on the street saying, "Hey, I want to share this thing with you." Who's out there inviting people that feel afraid to enter? I use against agave as a specific instance. So this is the thing. This is the biggest hurdle, I think. Because on Facebook groups, it's all just like-minded people. I mean, really, different backgrounds, of course. But the agave group that we've got in Austin, it's all people that already cared. But how do you get someone that's on the fence to come in?
Well,
and that's what I'm saying is the challenge.
Different categories.
And that's where bars and bar managers and bartenders have a role to play. That's where people who work in bars and run bars.
Did you clean your glass before you put the mezcal in there?
I did not put the mezcal.
Was this a toll?
Yeah, no, that would be a strange cognac and mezcal. That's actually interesting.
Could be good.
Yeah, it could be.
But that's where people who make the decisions on what to put on the back bar in a bar and educate themselves about it so that they can educate people across the bar.
Yeah.
That's where they have a responsibility.
Okay, and that's good. That's the conduit.
But I think the education's happening. A lot of times it's unfortunately you have to stair step, right? So I know people who I preach the good word of Pete and how great.
Whiskey Pete?
Nope.
You self-aggrandizing guy.
Yeah. No.
Before you take that step, do you want to?
Yes, please.
Make a lateral
I'm just,
move?
Yeah, I'm just giving a little clean here, so I'm trying to.
Thanks.
This will be the slightly higher proof earlier batch. This was purchased by Cecilia, who is the owner of La Niña de Mezcal. She didn't produce anything. She had no hands on telling Gerardo how to make the product. She just bought it and labeled it. And then this is
a little pepper in that.
Something that was produced, I want to say, 2 years later in the same facility by the same person with the same species of plant.
Dude, there's a... Try this one, because there's... No, I am going to lead you, because you know how to taste. But there's this cool punch of, peppered lemon. Not lemon pepper, because it's, lemon zest. But that's a real big difference between the two. This reads a little bit brighter and more acidic to me.
I'm definitely getting a bit of a...
This one reads brighter to you?
Yeah.
A sweeter note on the nose.
Yeah. I feel like it's got more punch, even though it is, like I said, it's 1 percentage point lower in ABV.
Mm-hmm.
More barnyard character to it.
Sure.
I get more hay. I get more funk.
Ooh, yeah definitely more hay. Yeah. It's
cool.
Yeah, so I say that a lot in the show. I couldn't be a bigger fan. Now, these couldn't be more different. There's definitely some... I mean, everything from the nose to the... I get more of that petrichor smell I love talking about so much. That
petrichor.
Stone, a wet stone.
Absolutely. Petrichor. One of my favorite things.
Tell me, I taste stuff all the time. What does petrichor mean?
Petrichor is these... So let's say you go outside, you know, and or maybe you're on a hike right after a fresh rain, and you can smell the wet stone.
I see.
So it's the smell of the cement after a fresh rain. And it's kind of earthy and stony and mineral in the air, and that is exactly what you get from here. It's
I mean,
or think also when you're out in West Texas in Marfa or somewhere around there, after it rains, all the creosote bushes open up, and there's this smell that you associate with fresh rain.
I get that whole thing. That's pretty, like, even from childhood we kind of understand, it smells like copper in the air, it's about to rain, or it's raining.
Sure.
It's in Arizona for a bit, and that the desert really opens up. But petrichor, I'm just saying.
Uh-oh.
It's a little,
is this
it's
more also a look at this guy. This guy is coming in hot.
No.
He's like, I got some things I want to say.
No one's
talking about it enough. No one's doing this right.
Rainy Earth, is that
United
is that
Wided
much?
Spirits?
Is that fun to say? Really?
Yeah, petrichor sounds cool, but it sounds like a grindcore band.
Okay, but in the same vein,
like something from Doctor Who, honestly.
In the same vein, every time you talk about these, you throw in a little Spanish accent. So,
but I have to. That's kind of paying homage to it.
You don't have to.
No. Bombois, that's how you would say it, okay?
Yeah, because you have no other option but to say it that way, right?
Petit champagne.
Bombois, right?
No, well, you could.
Yeah, the Bombois, obviously.
We all know the
Bombois. New band. Crazy.
No, wine, and that's one of the things, too, is the bien picado. I understand what that means, and I think it's important. You mentioned misappropriation, which I would have
to presume. Which, by the way, I'm joking. joking. It's a joke. Yeah. Because I don't.
It's a joke when it's applied to you.
Yeah.
However,
I know. So when you let's before we jump around too much, finish addressing something you said. Who's talking about it, introducing people to the category? Yeah. Okay, so what I was going to say is sometimes you have to stair step it. You go from, I know guys who are bourbon drinkers, and I want to get them to scotch. So I find the right scotch to get them into that you know, like I always mentioned, Glenfiddich 14 Bourbon Barrel Reserve. It's a great bourbon drinker scotch. But once you get into scotch, this whole time I'm thinking about peat. Right? I cannot wait to convince
you're
this person.
You're playing chess with these folks, aren't you?
I'm three moves ahead, right? You get from bourbon drinking.
You got
drinking
a bottle of Lagavulin behind your back just waiting.
You get from bourbon. It's almost like dating, right?
Yeah,
like
sure.
You're like, oh, yeah.
Is there potential here?
So I get them to scotch, then introduce them to the adventures of, I mean, it's all over the place between sherry and you get some cognac finished scotches now, like from Deanston, and of course, those beautiful islands that vary greatly in peat.
My favorite,
From there, right, you get them in love with peat. I fell in love with mezcal because I got introduced to some smokier versions of mezcal.
Yeah.
It's a stair-step adventure of like, oh, I'm playing hopscotch, and this is great. It's happening. It's happening. It's definitely my nod to bartenders. It definitely, I think, started there, as it does with most. You know, when you get into the industry as a bartender and you get hooked, you want to preach the good word to everybody.
Well, and that's absolutely where the resurgence of sherry came from. Bartenders started using it as a cocktail ingredient.
Yeah. New York Sour is one of my favorites.
And then you move from, you know, this, oh, there's this rare, weird thing that people don't really understand, but you can use it in cocktails, to being able to say, well, if you like that, then here, I'm just going to pour some Amontillado into a glass for you now.
Amontillado is
fantastic.
And
this will change your life. And sometimes it does.
I just know that, like, I guess, how many years ago did you make your first batch?
2016.
Yeah, so I remember, and our good friend Morgan brought in a bottle of it, and I did not think, being, this is where white privilege comes in, I didn't think that cultural appropriation was an issue when it came to spirits. I obviously, it's very, very common in food. When you see food fusion and these restaurants will do a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and it's all mingled together. When it came to spirits, I thought, I love your spirit. I want to make your spirit. That's why you started making Sotol.
Well, right.
And then it became a bit more hotly debated nowadays, especially in the Austin group, in your group, about whether it's offensive to call a Texas-based Sotol Sotol, and whether there's a historic precedence or that sort of thing. So my joke was definitely a joke when I told Morgan, you can really taste the cultural appropriation. I know that you have nothing but love and respect for the category.
All right, here's a few things. And this is the first time I've talked about it kind of publicly. It's been behind closed doors.
Before you get too far into that, I'm just like, my general thought on this is that there is a community around this thing, and whether or not you respect that community is immensely important.
That's right. Yeah.
And that's all. I just wanted to say that before you launch into what I feel like you're about to say.
So this is a conversation that I've had over drinks with folks like Drew and Leslie and stuff. And so here's a couple things. I did this thing because I love Mexico.
Sure.
Ricardo here, Esteban, with like these are people that have inspired me.
And you're also
me.
Very well respected by all these people. They all know, everyone knows Mike G, right?
I mean. Maybe, yeah. I really have no visibility into it. I just do the thing, right?
I'm
just kind of doing it. So, but I remember when I was even considering doing this Sotol thing. You know who the first person I talked to was? Ricardo. He was doing marketing for Hacienda de Chihuahua, and I DM'd him back and forth on Twitter. Beautiful man. He is open. He's friendly. So from the very, very get-go, in a sense, I was asking permission to do this thing.
And what did he say?
He's like, yes, of course, you know, do this thing. This is how we do it. And actually, one of the production methods, which I won't mention, from Hacienda de Chihuahua, I adopted. And it's different than what the other Texas Sotol does. And that's cool because you get some difference. So here's the thing. I always knew Sotol was rooted in Mexico. It was, if I was going to play on this stage, it would always be a nod to the men and women who were making Sotol all along. So if you erase all of that, all of the hundreds of years, the murders, the federales killing Sotoleros because it was a a threat to aged spirits in terms of revenue and stuff. Like, there's a rich, rich history there, right? And so we can play together. This can be unifying. It doesn't have to be something that is America versus Mexico.
So what is your thought on the feelings of, you know, like, for instance, there was some recent outrage when it broke on Twitter that there was a Swedish company making bourbon.
Right.
My initial instinct is to agree with you, but when I start getting, like, there's this beautiful sherry made in Texas called Chanza by McPherson Cellars. It's McPherson. It's delicious. It's fantastic, and it's great for $16. And then you find out, well, actually, it's pissing off this whole section of the population.
Well, here's one way of thinking about that issue, and it comes from the unspoken rules of satire. When you're doing satire, everybody knows that you're going to be making fun of somebody. It's assumed that's happening.
Sure.
The rule is you always punch up. You don't attack people who are more vulnerable than you are. The whole idea behind satire is that you're trying to level a playing field by bringing down people who are more powerful.
Sure.
Oh, wow.
So you're saying that, like, in the case of Chance or Sherry being so much more of a respected category than that...
Bourbon, especially, like, talking about somebody who's making bourbon in Sweden, like, they're violating the rules of how to name the thing.
Yeah, but, trade agreements, yeah.
But not reverence and respect to...
And respect, and also the people who stand to lose a little bit of market share because somebody in Sweden is making bourbon are far more secure, and they're doing far better.
So you
feel
like it's far more harmful for us to make Sotol here in the U.S.?
If you're depriving people who are in a community that is more vulnerable than you, more economically insecure, and also has a much deeper and richer history in this thing...
Yeah.
In that's the way that I think there's a moral issue.
Okay, so I could not, and I had never thought about it from a dynamic thing. When you express a narrative about Sotol that excludes where it comes from, excludes the people, the three states in Mexico that make Sotol, when you exclude that, you say, no, it's a Texas thing. I've met more people, and this is happening more and more. People brought it to my attention. They said, well, I've tried this Texas Sotol, and there's only one, and we know who we're talking about, but not
Desert
names.
Door, yeah.
Perhaps, right? So, they make Sotol in Mexico? And I was almost outraged, and I don't get it.
Sure.
I'm super chill. But I was like, those are the people that are set to economically benefit the most from including Sotol's recognition in the trade agreement.
Sure.
And we're like, nah. Senator Cornyn's like, nah, it's a Texas thing. I mean, this is very ridiculous. To Drew's point, the dynamic MBA students controlling the narrative to a group.
And we can cut this out if we have to, but I just would love to understand. So what's the difference between, as far as I know, there have been two Texas Sotols, yours and Desert Door. Mm-hmm. Why is everyone so mad at Desert Door but not mad at Mike? What's the difference in the dynamic?
I asked permission. I kissed the ring's too dramatic of a term, but I said, I want to do this. This is a love letter to y'all.
Well, you reached out to the community of people who historically have made this and who are active in continuing to make it and are supporting literal communities with the economic gains of doing this versus a group of people who have like the flimsiest of possible like familial history with contact with this thing, deciding that they were going to, as a fun MBA project, create a company, get a bunch of money behind it to market it heavily, blanket the state with marketing, to the exclusion and erasure of these people who have already been making it for a long time.
All right. So, and I haven't provided any opinions. I'm just asking questions. I don't want anyone to assume my thoughts on this.
What's your perspective?
So, what would you, as we can acknowledge that Del Maguey has created such attention to this category, could Desert Door not be doing the same? That now you've got people. So you're saying that it's taking away from them, but I don't. Is it really taking away
from
them?
Chris, this is the main point. Is that Del Maguey talks
whole episode,
right? And I'll try to keep this to 30 seconds. Del Maguey talks about mezcal. They've included multiple states.
So oh, I
it's
see.
not just Oaxaca, right? They've got Puebla now, and probably looking at some other states.
And they've got the names of the people who make it in Mexico on the bottle.
And it's totally varied. So the narrative is the category is large. It involves many different villages, many different mezcaleros, and different states. Cool. When you say, oh, this is Texas Sotol, and you don't ever mention that there were already three other states producing it for decades, if not centuries. Now, history's kind of like centuries.
Yes. Then really, they're just taking away from, I see what you're saying.
That's right. They're creating a vacuum. Well, no, Texas Sotol is a thing. It is not a thing. But the fact that that's even a brand or a concept that John Cornyn is actually repeating.
Who's John Cornyn?
He's the senator for Texas.
Oh, yeah.
He and Ted Cruz. Like, he's saying Texas Sotol. Where did he see that? What marketing? Well, I know which actually PR group came up with that, but it's not a thing.
So if Desert Door took a more widely approach to honor the history behind the brand, would they be more well-received, or are they permanently persona non grata?
They have the ability and the opportunity still to incorporate the agave community, people like we've mentioned that make these or import these sotoles. There is an opportunity, a massive one, for, again, unity with Mexico. But that has not been the case. And there are certain limitations that I've understood from them in terms of security clearance and stuff in which they can't actually do that stuff.
Well, I invited somebody from Desert Door to go to the most recent Sotol Fest, which was an opportunity to meet people from Mexico who had crossed over from Chihuahua into Terlingua and who were bringing their products legally to showcase. And it was an opportunity for somebody from Desert Door to go and shake hands and meet and talk to traditional Sotol producers.
Sure.
And they passed.
So I could understand, as Mike Cameron from Devil's River can attest, that when you do feel like persona non grata, that it might be easier just to pass than to... it's a lose-lose situation. And again, I know nothing about Desert Door. I do know what I've seen the hated ones in the community. I had the director from the TABC in here, General Bentley Nettles, and there was a lot of things we couldn't discuss because he just didn't. And he came off as a really nice, genuine guy. But when you are seen as the
you're the enemy.
The enemy.
The antagonist.
Yeah. The evil empire.
Mm-hmm.
So, I have no dog in the fight. I love the category. I love what it tastes like. I'm very, you can very clearly, and we'll put a feather in the terroir discussion, very clear differences, same plant, same species of plant, same place that it was made. The only difference is age and location, meaning the time between distillation runs.
Right. I want to say this last piece as a bookend because I know we've got our monitor. I'm getting good at this stuff.
Sure.
10 seconds. But the only way the conversation will change is if it's not dominated by the only way the conversation will change is if it's not dominated by a single force, right? And the only way that that'll happen is if I get back to making, and then I can bring my bottles here and we can talk about it again. And so that's
is that why you did two batches and you stopped because of the issue around it, or
no, it was all supplier stuff actually, and money. When money gets involved, things change profoundly. So this will change, this conversation will evolve, and I hope that I can have more of these conversations with the fine sotoleros and also the people making the sotol.
I appreciate you guys coming.
Of course, man.
Good seeing you, brother.
Yeah, likewise.
Very nice meeting you, Drew.
Thank you so much.
And cheers, guys.
Balcones' first ever year-round bourbon was an inspiration. It all had to work together. A blend of carefully selected ingredients, Texas-sized pot stills, and creative people determined to find the absolute best way to usher a new whiskey along. When you discover how it pairs with a meaningful moment, suddenly the feeling of drinking great whiskey becomes a whole lot more.